It is Sunday, September 15th, 2013, and this is episode 35 of the Defensive Security Podcast. My name is Jerry Bell, along with Andrew Kellett.
Good evening to all of our valued listeners.
Thank you. As usual, the thoughts and opinions we express on this podcast are ours and do not represent those of our employer, and that's probably a good thing. So tonight's show is probably going to be a little bit shorter than normal, and a big reason is that normally I spend a lot of time reading news articles about security stuff, and you know I kind of drop it in to a Google Drive and you know keep it for later, and then I go back. But this week I was totally unable to do that because I was so taken with serious research on twerking. I mean, It's all over the internet.
If anyone needs a co-host for a podcast, I'm going to be available.
See, I knew you'd like it. All right, moving on. So I would just also like to point out that it is, in fact, September 15th, which is 4 days after September 11th, and the internet is still up and running, which yet again means Anonymous continues to lose ground in credibility.
They're coming after us now. You just called them out.
Well, yeah. Don't attack us. I'm just calling a spade a spade. So the first thing I wanted to talk about after obviously twerking and Anonymous was I'm trying really hard to make Andy spit out his beer. is something that I did notice in the news, and you may have heard about this. There was a company called TrendNet. TrendNet makes Wi-Fi video cameras, and I guess a lot of them are used for nanny cams or nursery cams. And there was a real big hoopla about some neighbor yelling at a kid through the cam. Anyway, that's all behind us. What has happened is the Federal Trade Commission in the U.S. has actually filed a sanction against TrendNet. And essentially, if this finding holds, TrendNet's actually going to have to go through a security audit by an independent researcher twice a year for 20 years. Every 2 years for 20 years. That's a pretty big deal. And I think they're also going to be...
Which makes me wonder, who knows who at the auditing company that just gave him a 20-year contract?
Well, you know, what's even more interesting is I dug a little bit more into this, and I recall this actually happening to HTC earlier in the year. And in fact, mm-hmm. It did. And what was interesting, when you look at both of these cases, HTC and this one, the FTC is using a pretty controversial hammer about deceptive marketing practices. And so, you know, they're basically saying, you know, you're marketing this product as being secure and it's putting consumers at risk.
So define secure and define risk.
Well,
I mean, that's the challenge they've got here, right? They're taking this sort of subjective approach of, obviously, in this case, TrendNet was, you know, silly, right? They were what the FTC was alleging and was proven was that they were sending everything in the clear, and it was easy to go to the centralized website and browse anyone's feed. Yeah, that's just straight up silliness, right? But if they're gonna hold the standard out there of you, if you're gonna say you're secure, you have to be secure. Who defines what secure is? And who defines what, you know, appropriate levels is? This goes back to a little bit, it harkens to me to the concept of the PCI standard, which is, you know, your QSA defines whether or not your PCI is secure or not. and it has very little to do with actual reality. So this is interesting to me that the FTC is suddenly jumping into this arena and quote unquote protecting consumers, unquote, in this way, which, you know, is a bit of an interesting thing as companies. If you're putting a product out there, now you've got one more thing to consider. But, you know, so far I haven't seen the FTC do anything that is, you know, not blatantly obvious to anyone with a clue that, yes, this was badly configured and badly built. And but what happens when somebody does try to do the right things and they do make a best effort and still have somebody break it or a really good hacker figure out a way in? Are they going to be held accountable then? And what unintended consequences does that have? Right. And not to, you know, go off too far down a rat hole, but we've talked about, you know, Microsoft could put out a secure operating system, but it would take them 8 years to develop and cost $20 million a copy. Right. And so then you start wondering how this sort of thing will have impacts.
Yeah. So it's interesting. I didn't realize it, but the FTC has actually hit 50 companies with this kind of thing in the past related to security, and
wow, that's huge.
They're actually available on the FTC site, and I have a link to that in the show notes. But what I find interesting, one of the interesting things is that there's a company called LabMD, actually here in Atlanta. A couple of years ago, they got owned and had some data stolen, and it was interesting to me that apparently the HIPAA regs didn't get them, but the FTC did. And they're actually taking the FTC to court and challenging their authority to use this rule to enforce security.
Yeah, that's definitely an article worth introducing as well, because there's some weird stuff in that one.
Yeah.
You know, you want to give a little background on that and we can talk about it?
Yeah. So hang on 1 second. Let me pull it up.
I've got it here. I can give some background.
Go ahead, please.
All right. It's my first background. Yay. So this is interesting. LabMD, long story short, they had a spreadsheet end up on some peer-to-peer networks. So they don't say which one, but probably some sort of torrent, probably some sort of, you know, aggregator out there that included completely unencrypted all sorts of personal identifier information, including social security numbers, names, date of birth, health insurance provider information, standardized medical treatment codes, all sorts of stuff. Now, the FTC said this was bad, understandably so. Now, what's interesting is LabMD is saying, we're going to fight you on this one, and that the FTC has overstepped its bounds in authority in bringing these types of complaints. And what's also interesting, and this is where it's kind of gets a little fuzzy, and it could be just some FUD being thrown out there, but LabMD is saying that they shared some information as part of a research project involving a P2P security vendor, Traversa, if I'm pronouncing that correctly. Traversa then tried to use its possession of a LabMD, I'm quoting the article here, Traversa then tried to use its possession of a LabMD spreadsheet to convince the medical lab to buy its security service. So, you know, this, at least if you read a little bit between the lines here, this is possibly a situation where a vendor found this or somehow caused this to happen and is pressuring LabMD to buy their services. I don't know. I have no idea, right? So I'm not alleging that, but it's very interesting that there's some twists and turns in this, but I do find it interesting that LabMD is fighting them in court. And, you know, clearly it's going to be an interesting thing to watch, because this could be precedent setting if the FTC loses this. And, you know, this reminds me a little bit of when Elliot Spitzer was just the you know, district attorney in New York, and how he was bringing some landmark cases against a lot of the financial industry long before he was, you know, found to be, you know, kind of a prostitute purveyor. And a lot of people were challenging that he didn't have the authority to do it, but he did bring about some change. So it'll be interesting to see.
Yeah. And conversely, if they are found to be appropriate in their use of that rule, I think potentially you could see even more application of this rule against different companies. And that was one of the reasons I wanted to bring this up, because, you know, it's not all about necessarily bad press, right? You know, there are sometimes some non-obvious ramifications to doing some things poorly or badly or half-assed or however you want to say it. You've got to really pay attention, especially when you are putting out a product. And especially in the case of security vendors, I have to wonder, how has some of the antivirus or firewall vendors or what have you not gotten swept up in this based on some of the things that have happened, you know? And I have to wonder if the FTC is supported in any future litigation that happens. You know, I wonder if we might see some security vendors falling into their sites.
Well, this is an interesting thing, right? And this starts across a little bit into politics. And I'm a pretty hardcore libertarian. And at some point, there's a caveat emptum issue here of the buyer beware. And at what point, does it become the government's job to protect the consumer against their idea of insecure products or insecure software, right? Whereas at the same time, these are highly complex technical issues. And, you go back to the TrendNet example of a webcam that was marketed as secure, but based on some subjective criteria, them transmitting in the clear and anybody being able to browse a quote-unquote private web session, they were found insecure, right? So at one point, is that the consumer's responsibility to figure that out, or is it too complicated for the consumer? And then how in the world is the government, with their amazing technical capabilities, going to figure that out? It's interesting. Does this have a chilling effect on people trying new and interesting services? And, I know this is kind of crossing the line a little bit into politics, but this is something of a, it's a new risk, right? If the FTC is suddenly going to start investigating you for, you said you were secure, but, oh, look, a hacker from Iran found a way to break it.
Exactly.
You're not secure. Well, guys, let's be honest. It's incredibly difficult to make anything hacker-proof, right? I remember back in the day when Oracle said that their database was hack-proof. Bad plan, right? So then it becomes, okay, is there a minimum level of security effort that must be, presented? Have they done their due diligence to a certain level? Great. Has anybody presented that? Has anybody codified that? Is that something that vendors can go look at? No. So this is kind of certainly, we can see some egregious examples of this and folks who are just, completely out of left field, not even trying to be secure. We can all go, yep, they, I'm glad somebody's doing something about that. But at the same time, where is that line between good intentions, bad implementation, and, just completely bad intentions?
Yeah. And I think to an extent, in some of these cases, the law doesn't necessarily care about intentions. They only really care about outcomes. And, that's unfortunate sometimes. And sometimes you may be able to make it a position that it makes sense for it to be that way. But, you brought up an interesting point, and I run into this quite a lot. A lot of regulations, both here in the U.S. and globally, related to security and data protection are completely non-prescriptive. It's basically you have to protect the data. Well, how do you have to protect the data? Well, you use commercially reasonable standards. Well, what does that mean? Well, basically it means if your data doesn't get breached, it was adequate. And if it gets breached, it wasn't adequate.
Well, what this reminds me of is the reasonable man standard when you start talking about legal issues with the jury.
Yes.
Right? So if we equate this back to another political hot button of self-defense, right? Somebody breaks into my house and I shoot them and kill them. Right, the standard is what a reasonable man on the street, and maybe I should use the the reasonable
gender
person.
Neutral.
Thank you,
yes.
Gender neutral. It's late on a Sunday. The gender neutral reasonable person on the street have done the same thing, right? So then it comes down to, is that what we're talking about here? What is industry standard? What is reasonable approach? And again, that can get really squishy,
right.
Especially around IT stuff.
Yeah, particularly because it can vary pretty dramatically from industry to industry. So what's reasonable at a bank is completely different than what's reasonable at a construction company.
Yeah, it's a good point. So I don't know that we have a lot of advice on this one other than be aware of it and, you know, stay tuned and keep watching it. But it's interesting the FTC is sticking their toes into this water.
Yeah, definitely.
It bears definite further watching.
Well, moving on, somewhat related. So there is a healthcare company called Advocate Healthcare, and, well, they lost a lot of data. 4 million records, to be exact. Is it? Yeah, 4 million. And the way they lost it was the ultra-high-tech way of having some desktops stolen from their office. And, you know, I'm a big advocate of trying to figure out where it makes sense to make security investments in your company, right? Should you invest in application whitelisting, or should you invest in intrusion detection or something else, right? But let me tell you this. You can't get by without endpoint encryption. I mean, it is so fundamental. As an organization, you have no clue, generally, what people have on their computers, right? If you know, especially if you're a bank or a healthcare company, or you know, heck, even most regular companies provide insurance to their employees. You know, you have generally no assurance that there isn't sensitive data. It's such a fundamental thing. It's kind of like brushing your teeth or taking a shower. You know, this is not like, you know, advanced security stuff. It's happening all the time. Go to datalossdb.org and, you know, search on any criteria and look at how many instances involve the theft of a laptop or a workstation or a server or a USB drive. You've got to encrypt it. It's not optional.
So what makes this story interesting?
That people aren't getting it.
So what I thought interesting was that people are filing a class action lawsuit against them for it.
Yes.
That that the folks who, of the 4 million, so what the data that was in here was personal identifiable information, right? So it's, you know, all the typical stuff of name, date of birth, social security number, addresses, everything that makes an identity thief's job really easy. And again, go back to the point of why can't we change our social security number? Why can't we make life a lot easier? All right, moving on. So these 4 million folks who had all their records leaked because the data was completely in the clear are now getting into a class action lawsuit against this company, right? Which can be extremely expensive for the defense and very lucrative for the lawyers, but, you know, not so lucrative for the endpoint folks. So that's what's interesting, right? They are now filing a class action lawsuit against this company saying, hey, you didn't properly secure our data. And, you know, this is the kind of stuff that can put companies out of business and probably will, depending on how this goes. So I agree with you, right? Full disk encryption. It's pretty trivial to implement. It's pretty trivial to roll out. It is not a panacea, though. You know, end of the day, right? If your password to get into the box is trivial, like, I don't know, password ABC123, hey, look, the operating system happily decodes it all for you, right? So it's only stopping one particular easy avenue of attack, right? But it's a very, very strong way of stopping that avenue of attack. It's extremely effective, but you still have to pair it with strong login passwords.
Yeah, and don't write that password and stick it to the side of the computer.
Right. Right. So, you know, the other thing I found interesting about this article is that we don't know that this information, as far as I know, is ever actually utilized or leaked in any way.
No. And I'll tell you from, you know, well, let's just say I have this friend, Bob, right? And you know, he works at a company that happens to see drives and data stolen every now and then. And, you know, you always have to treat that, or let me say that he has to always treat those kinds of cases as if the worst thing possible that could be done with that data was done with that data. And you know, one of the, I've had to do some research on breach notification, and 46 out of the 50 states in the U.S. has breach notification laws.
Sure.
Where you have to notify the attorney general. Some of them actually will require you to go directly to the media and tell them what was done. The EU has even more stringent requirements, and those are really developing all around the world.
Well, you know, somewhat off topic, but around the breach notification, that's one reason why I've been involved with some certain projects that part of what the customer or the company that had an issue does first is they do some malware reverse engineering to figure out what a particular piece of malware exfiltrated out, mm-hmm. to understand what was breached, to understand the scope of their breach notification, completely separate from this. This is right. The physical asset theft here. But the money they spent on the malware reverse engineering cut their breach notification by 90% in this particular case that I know of, which was, you know, huge. Because if you don't know what the malware is actually targeting, you don't know what it actually is exfiltrating, you don't know, and you have to assume the worst. By right. you know, by statute in most cases, and I'm not a lawyer, but so that's one thing that's interesting. So in this case, you know, as best we can tell, these guys lost 4 million personal PII records, and ultimately had to disclose all 4 million of them. When we have no idea if those hard drives just got burned, right? You know, just yep. completely nuked and yep. paved and reformatted and sold and. So end of the day, like the basics, full disk encryption probably cost you, I don't know, $10 a node, $20 a node, depending on how many you have. And you could have at least said you took reasonable precaution. However, how many people do it on desktops, right? These weren't laptops. These were desktops, right? Or servers.
I'll tell you, if you just go through DataLossDB, and I invite anybody to do this, go through DataLossDB and especially focus on the PHI losses, which is, you know, where you really have to report in a timely manner. There's a lot of physical workstations, physical desktops stolen out of offices, you know, just the general breaking and entering. And you know, you're right. A lot of companies don't encrypt those because they say, well, those don't ever leave the building.
Right.
Well, they don't leave the building except under adverse circumstances.
It doesn't necessarily change the advice here, but my question would be, just out of curiosity, is of those theft, how many are for the hardware and how many are for the actual data? And my gut would be the vast majority would be for the hardware.
I would bet so. I would bet you're right. Hard but, to say,
you know,
for sure.
I don't have any hard data on that. Not saying you shouldn't still take reasonable precautions. But, you know, it's not like you've got a black bag team sneaking into your office at night from a foreign state, you know, funded adversary to steal your hardware. Now, you might, right? I mean, if that's what the level of your data, you know, if you're a tier one military supplier, yeah, they might go for that. In which case, yeah, you better damn well have some good full disk encryption going on.
Right.
But, you know, at the end of the day, full disk encryption is a solved problem, as we say. And it should be, you know, as trivial in terms of funding as antivirus.
Yeah. And by the way, I'm also not a lawyer. However, I do work closely with many. So I encourage you to seek your own legal counsel. But generally, if your drive is encrypted with a reasonable full disk encryption solution, that loss is not reportable. Again, seek your own legal counsel, but that's been my experience.
Yeah, it's interesting. So, yeah, at the end of the day, it's interesting in a couple of points. The fact that they're going after a class action is interesting, and that could start a floodgates of this sort of thing.
Yes.
And this, you know, somewhat, I remember when the TJ Maxx hack happened, and we were like, oh, TJ Maxx is going out of business, and their stock's going to get crippled. You know, the reality is, the sad reality is now everybody's getting hacked, and now it's become a not necessarily a shame point on the company, and it's not hurting their business so much anymore as it is a lot of consumers feel that it's somewhat inevitable, and they just sort of go, well, you know, everybody's getting hacked, and it's
right.
become normal complacence, commonplace sort of thing. I think that's bad. But when you start spinning up class action lawsuits, that changes the equation a little bit.
Yes.
You know,
Yeah.
to company destroying levels of actions potentially. So we shall
Depending
see.
on how large the company is, for
Yeah.
sure. I need to go find the article. I actually did read it. I was ripping out some plumbing, or maybe I listened to it. I don't remember. But there was a case, and I'll find this for next week. There was a case where a company had secured some cyber insurance, right? And
$5 in the tip jar.
well, this company lost some data, and it didn't. this insurance didn't cover the cost of some lawsuits that were brought against them. It covered some, I think, like credit monitoring and things like that, but it didn't cover some of the really significant costs. So, you know, again, your point is very well made that, you know, while these attacks are becoming kind of passe, and I mean not in a trivial way, right? But they're just becoming kind of everyday things. They're almost not news anymore.
Right.
And if you go back and look at the stock chart for TJ Maxx or Sony, right, you will see a dip that's associated with it, but it goes right back up. I
Yeah.
mean, it might take a quarter or 2 quarters, but it isn't a company-ending thing. But, you know, if you are sued $1 billion or $2 billion or $3 billion because you lose a lot of data, you know, that's an entirely different thing.
Right.
And depending on how big you are, that could be everything.
2 points. One, it might be career ending for certain folks, you know,
Yes.
especially those who might be listening to this podcast. And two, when you say ripping up plumbing, is that a euphemism of some variety?
No.
Okay, moving on.
No, you see, I am constantly improving my house, and you know, sometimes the builder didn't put, you know, stuff where it should be. They didn't think about me. They didn't think about how I was going to live in this house. So anyway, let's move on. The last thing we're going to do is our new segment, which is kind of looking at an attack technique and kind of digging into it. So we had a request from one of our listeners to talk about man in the middle attacks. And you know, as you pointed out rightly, Andy, man in the middle isn't, you know, isn't an attack unto itself. It's a technique. And that technique can be applied to lots of different scenarios. And so the other thing we talked about before the show, which I think, you know, there's not a good way to weave it in, so I'll just kind of throw it out there. This is a gigantic space, and
Yeah.
Andy pointed this out, right? We could probably talk about Man in the Middle for the next 3 hours. There's a whole large space. And so in my mind, what I wanted to do is kind of focus it on how is it most likely to manifest itself, and how should organizations, or why should organizations, and where should organizations care about it? So, first question is it real? And you know, my answer is yes, right? I don't know, what do you think?
Yeah. I mean, well, let's back up just a tad and say, you know,
Sure.
how would you define a man in the middle attack? Because it is a bit of a potentially squishy term, and we were talking
Well,
about
true.
this earlier. Like we were talking about what's the difference between a man in the middle attack, man in the browser attack. You know,
True.
there's many sorts of different, architecture terms that could be applied here. You know, and I'll just throw mine out is that anytime somebody's intercepting and modifying or intercepting and replaying or in any way sort of getting in between a communication to in some way modify it maliciously. Now, that could be representing an endpoint, that could be, you know, modifying that data, that could be all sorts of stuff, right? And sometimes, by the way, we use this for good. You know, if we talk about tools like from a company called Proofpoint, which will take a look at URLs that come in an email. And if those URLs might be malicious, it rewrites the URL to go to a proxy server to prevent somebody from clicking on a phishing link. that is a man in the middle, but it is used for good, right? So it is, in my mind, some way of intercepting and, you know, sort of proxying a communication for some sort of ill intent.
Yeah, indeed. I think a lot of commercial web proxy solutions will act as a man in the middle, where you can install a root certificate on your endpoints, and it'll it'll look at the unencrypted content of SSL sessions.
Right, right. Which again, that's man in the middle, right? But that allows them to not just have that stuff flow past encrypted, which they can't look at.
Right.
But that's also very resource intensive, just as an aside.
Yes.
But so that being said, what is your definition of a man-in-the-middle attack?
So I guess my definition is more generic. It's sitting in the middle of a traffic flow and potentially presenting different versions of traffic to each node, right? And so in the context of the proxy solution, right, they're exchanging different SSL certificates, and they're between the workstation and the proxy, and then the proxy and the web server. They each think they're talking to the actual endpoint, but this quote man in the middle is sitting there, and so that man in the middle can take many forms, right? It can take the form of a rogue wireless access point, which is actually one of the use cases that I want to bring up, because I think that is something that a lot of organizations should be thinking about.
So what is man in the middle exploiting? In my mind, it's exploiting an inherent trust.
Yes.
You're trusting that channel of whatever.
Correct.
It is, right?
Right.
And so if that is the weakness, the trust, how do we verify a trust, which in my mind goes to how do we know if a man in the middle exists, right? So it is, it's a technique, right? And it can be used for a lot of things. It can be used for, when we first had come on the scene way back in the Stone Age days, two-factor authentication from SecureID. I was like, this is the panacea. This is the best thing ever. This will stop all hacksawers. Well, very quickly people figured out, no, as long as I can intercept you within 60 seconds, replay it, your two-factor authentication, I just got your PIN and your token code, and now I have your passcode. And as long as I get it replayed within 60 seconds, I'm good to go, right? So it is a technique, and it's a technique that, especially I see most often with web browsing. And I think we've trained our users now, or not trained, but, users in general are, hey, we had this wonderful facility within web browsers to check to see if a certificate for an SSL cert was good, which gave us not only encryption, but authentication. Well, now we no longer trust, those of us in the know, those authentication. However, the vast majority of people look at that little box and say, yep, this is my valid site.
Yep, the lock is closed and it's green. Must be good.
But we now know there are so many ways to get a signed cert that are trusted by browsers that, yeah, it's not perfect. It's not foolproof. But how many users just click past error messages and click past alerts and click past this is untrusted, especially when we now have so many self-signed certs that have circulated internally on all this gear? How many times do you go to a server and get a self-signed cert alert and you're just now trained to just say, yep, accept it, confirm it, save it.
Especially in intranet contexts, a lot of companies that I've seen in the past don't have the forethought to actually set up a formal internal certificate authority and then do root key distribution.
Exactly. Especially, this BYOD throws a whole nother monkey into that wrench, right? I bring my iPad in. I'm certainly not going to get a root cert from you to trust the internal SSL or SSH stuff. So,
yeah.
End of the day, that's one that I think is a very, very, very common avenue of attack is the web area.
So how do we protect against it?
That's a good, tough question. And I think if it's for stuff that really, really matters, I don't know that I have a great answer. User education is not going to solve it. We almost have to go back to the infrastructure of browser certs and take a look at how we want to deal with that. It really is a tough problem. I think the first thing is don't just inherently trust. Question your assumptions. Question, is this a secure channel? How do I know it's a secure channel? Unless there's a secondary out-of-band mechanism, you really can't trust it, right? You can kind of trust it, but unless there is a secondary, and we're starting to see some of that, right? We're seeing things like SMSing back passcodes and, other things like that. But for the vast majority of users and the vast majority of situations, I don't know that we have a great answer right now on some of it. When we talk about web, I think it's fundamentally broken right now. And you could go to the next step. How do I trust DNS? How do I trust that somebody hasn't? Because DNS is a race condition. In fact, there are folks out there who are security vendors that their entire mechanism on a DNS query to return. Let me back that up. There are vendors out there that are trying to do DNS security, and they're trying to say when certain bad things look up bad domains, to stop their communication, I'm going to try to return a proxied black hole IP address instead. So their entire mechanism is based on a race condition with DNS servers,
Nice.
right? Which tells you that they're, ignoring DNSSEC for a moment, tells you that DNS is purely, especially UDP, a completely unauthenticated mechanism. So this gets into all sorts of things like hash poisoning and DNS, all sorts of ways to molest DNS. And so once that happens, once I can molest DNS, and so instead of going to CNN.com, I bring you to a website that looks just like CNN.com but has my phishing site. What are you going to do? How do you know? Is that a man in the middle attack? I would say it is.
Yes, I agree.
It's really, really tough to defend against right now. I hate to be like, Mr. Cynical, but I mean, what are your thoughts? How do you defend against that?
Well, a couple of things. One is I think if you've got unauthenticated traffic, it's almost an impossible task. So you really have to rely on some kind of encryption, and it's still problematic. So my suggestions are a couple of things. Number one is, going back to your point about being able to trust the channel, and I hadn't really thought about this previously, it just kind of came up as we were talking here, and that is full tunnel VPNs, right? So if you're on if you're on a link that you don't trust, you're at a hotel or at a bar, at a restaurant,
Sure.
whatever, you can do a full tunnel VPN to your, hey, you can even get, personal VPN accounts
Are you trying to
now.
get personal with me, Jerry?
Well, yeah, that's for after the show, though.
Oh, I see.
We're
No,
not there yet.
that's a great idea, though. Not the getting personal part. The bad thing about SSL is it's an ad hoc mechanism, right?
Yes.
Right? The nice thing about TrueVPN is not. You have to have a pre-shared secret at some point ready.
Correct.
So that is a lot more trustworthy. I do love that suggestion a lot.
Yeah, and it lets you basically, for just so everybody understands, right? It lets you egress from a more or less trusted point. I mean, again, nothing's ever safe, but if the thing you're really worried about is, I'm at a security conference, or I'm at at a Starbucks and there's some shady person sitting in the corner. With lots of laptops and wireless looking gear, how do I make sure I'm not being man in the middle? It's a reasonable thing. Again, it's not entirely bulletproof. By the way, just look at what is it, MS CHAP, right? So you have to be somewhat cognizant of the underlying protocols that you're using, so you're not kind of using something that's double bad, right? It's easy to get compromised. But if you're using some reasonably current solution, it's probably a good thing. Now, some other ideas I had, There's a guy named Marley Moxie Marlinspike. Damn. Wow. Who's a really smart security researcher.
And for the record, Jerry's not drinking at all. I haven't seen him drink at all this entire show.
I'm not.
I, on the other hand, have had one beer that's kicking my ass, but carry on. It's Lagunitas 9%, and it's Lucky 13, and this, I know the listeners may not care, but maybe they do. And it's good, but it is kicking my ass, so I apologize.
Yeah, he's wobbling. I'm watching him here.
Sorry, so Moxie.
So anyway, he came up with this thing called Convergence, and it's a browser plugin. I think it's only for Firefox or Chrome. I don't remember which. But anyway, the idea was to add some reputability to what you're seeing on SSL transactions. And so the idea is, if you're on a network that you don't trust, let's say you're at Starbucks and there is somebody sitting in the corner with some gear, and you know they're pretending to be the Starbucks Wi-Fi, they capture your traffic, they do some SSL strip, they man in the middle you, and now they're watching, they're in between you and your bank, right? So, you know, we can debate how that might happen all day long, but that's not the point, right? The point is that convergence does is it lets your computer reach out and talk to a number of different computers out elsewhere on the internet and ask them from their perspective, what does the SSL certificate for the site I'm trying to get to look like? And then I can check that against the certificate I get back. And if there's something, there's a difference, something's going on.
That's beautiful. I love that.
It's now, really elegant.
It is. It's, you know, and, you know, this is something we were talking about on the pre-show, which is, you know, if you really don't trust, if you're really like being paranoid, you know, fire up a completely separate laptop, get it on MiFi, right? So you're going out over your various cell phones, 4G, 3G, whatever it may be for you, and go out and look there too, right? And you can start comparing different things. But that's beautiful. You know, as long as you've got no malware on your endpoint that is smart enough to rewrite that, which I'm thinking is incredibly zero probability. But so how do you scale that up to an enterprise level?
Well, I think that is the problem, right?
It's what if you're a bank? What if you're a bank and you want to assure your customers that the SSL cert they're getting, right, that your customers who are granny and grandpa out in Kansas, and I love Kansas, don't get me wrong, but are not technically savvy, and they're doing online bill pay, how do you find a way to protect them from a man-in-the-middle attack?
You know, this seems like it would be something good. Now, I will tell you, you know, the problem is it's going to present itself as a browser plugin. Right. So what do we know is going to happen? Oh, download my bank protection plugin.
Right.
which is going to do the exact opposite. So it's like you're damned if you do, you're damned if you don't. I don't know. This is a really good problem. And I bet there's some serious money to be made in solving this problem.
I really wish I had some more time to research on this one. This is one I think we could revisit on a couple of shows, because this really comes back to fundamentally trusting the channel.
Yes.
And how do you authenticate the channel?
Right.
Without secondary out-of-band authentication mechanism.
Right.
Right. You know, because this is the age-old problem with encryption. This is why one-time pads were so useful. But they had to be presented out-of-band, right? I had to give somebody the other decryption codes out-of-band. And this is the same problem. How can I trust the channel? And so the only takeaway I can really give on this topic is understand the technology behind that channel and really question the assumptions you're putting into that trust. If it's something that is truly, truly valuable to you, don't trust ad hoc VPNing. Find another way that you have a true, secure, pre-shared secret VPN setup.
Yes.
But that is not always viable. This is a tough problem. No. You know, we built the internet, we built Wi-Fi, and we built all these other things on an assumption of trust that is so easily broken and so easily violated, and so easily spoofed. You know, it's a tough one. It's a tough one. I feel like I'm letting the listeners down by not having more good, actionable, valid techniques on this one.
Well, I think the problem is that there aren't good solutions, right? And I know
some and that's the kind of raw truth you get on the Defensive Security Podcast.
I know that there are some organizations that guide their employees away from using untrusted access points. They say, if you need to get on the internet, you're going to use this hotspot.
You know, there are probably people screaming at their podcast listening devices right now that there are certain point solutions for certain point applications, right? There are probably vendors out there.
Sure.
You know, who have certain point solutions for certain point problems along this. And this is the challenge we have, right? When you take a look at this broad category of attacks, there's probably solutions for certain things in certain, you know, so this is where it's difficult to know all solutions, especially those that are, you know, kind of in like infancy mode.
Fair enough. That's a good point.
You know, so, you know, do your own research. But I think the key takeaway here is think about, understand, know what a metamodal attack is, know how it can be used against you, and understand within the context of your environment how and where you need to think about defenses against it.
Right. And what tools are available to you.
Right.
You know, like the single tunnel or full tunnel VPN, right? You know, it's relatively simple and straightforward and probably a good idea to use anyway. So that might be an option. You know, keeping your DNS secure, as we've talked about, is very, very important. You know, that's I think going to go a long way as well. So, you know, we didn't even touch on the topic of man in the browser, which is a whole nother level of depth here. And I think you're right. We should put a little more thought into it and come back in maybe a week or two and take another run at it.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's a topic that absolutely bears a lot of discussion, and I think we need to chunk it into more manageable chunks and look at really viable defensive techniques.
Yeah, and I mean, honestly, this week I was so busy watching twerking videos that I really didn't have time to do this topic justice.
And did you see the one where the girl caught on fire?
No.
Really?
No, I didn't.
Wow, it's been massively viral. Spoiler warning, it's a hoax. Jimmy Kimmel put it together.
You've ruined the internet for me.
You know what? And there are cats. Cats on the internet. There. Now you know everything about the internet.
Great.
Twerking videos and cats.
All right. For just in closing, right, I know that generally there's a lot of people that deeply value the seriousness of this podcast, and I apologize. You know, this was my fault, and I'll try to do better in the future.
We can deliver absolutely valuable, valid, serious content while still...
Fair enough.
...having conversations about twerking. No, we really can't, actually.
No,
no, we really can't.
That's my point.
See?
I'm apologizing because...
Right. I'm not going to interrupt your apology any further. Please.
I screwed up. I screwed up. I'm sorry.
You know what? I may have to relieve you of your command.
Dang. 35.
This is how the coup begins.
All right. Well, that's it for another week. I really appreciate everybody's time. And, you know, as always, if you have any thoughts, opinions, critiques, you really, really hate my diversions, you know, let me know. info@defensivesecurity.org. If you have any ideas for things that you'd like to talk about or us to talk about, or questions you'd like us to answer, whatever, you know, send us an email or hit us up on Twitter @DefensiveSec. You can find me on Twitter at Malicious Link. You can find Mr. Kellett on Twitter at Lurg. And with that, Mr. Kellett, say goodbye.
Have a great week. We will talk to you soon.
All right. Thanks a lot. Have a good one. Take care. Bye.